Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Welcome to Voices in Courage. We're with Jeannie Erickson today, and mom dealing with the son in addiction, similar to my story. So I was really curious to talk to Jeannie to find out, you know, really from her perspective, what has the journey been for her and what has she learned lesson wise? And are there any resources she can share with our audience? So Jeannie, I'm going to turn it over to you and ask you to just share, you know, your journey with your son and start there.
Great. Thank you, Kathy.
Welcome.
My journey with my son started when he was about 14, divorced family. And I don't know if that has any bearing. I've seen people with whole families that have everything and they still fall prey to addiction. Thomas started sampling smoking marijuana and it was very casual. I knew he started sneaking things around the house as far as not being truthful and doing activities that I wasn't aware of and was typically combative when I would address it with him. So, you know, fast forward, he was in sports. He was very bright in school. He was doing really well at wrestling and football in high school. And his senior year, they did, as far as consequences, they did a camp at U of O for the seniors that looked promising for scholarships. And so they did a football camp. Well, he decided that he was okay to smoke marijuana in the dorm on campus. And so in the middle of the night was the first call that I got on this journey saying, you need to come get your son. This is absolutely forbidden. This is non-negotiable. He got kicked off the team. He got kicked off of the wrestling team. He was eliminated from any opportunity for scholarships. And that was really painful, more for him than me, because those two were his passion. Didn't stop him from getting a good education. He went off to Oregon State. He got a degree. Again, a college guy, sampling the adventures of life, living in a house with, you know, 9 other young men. I'm sure there was all kinds of great opportunities to try and sample different things. Once he got out of college, again, his journey, he's such a great young person that he continued to be dishonest with his addiction. His drugs of choice that I knew of, again, was primarily marijuana. Married the love of his life. That was not an option for her. He swore that he wasn't smoking pot. She set a line in the sand. She divorced him. She left him. And so, you know, that was his second loss. And it was very sad. It hurt my heart because I knew that that was a really important relationship. From there, he got a degree in wood science, and he was quite the great negotiator with people. He was very extraordinary as far as warm and inviting and very technical. He could understand and really relate to all different walks of people. And it opened doors for him. You know, he worked for some prominent companies. I won't name names, but he was in supervisory positions and they actually relocated him up to Washington. And again, the stories just continued. He lost his job because of a fight, and a gal that he was with at the time called and said, no, he lost his job because of drugs. And he chose to continue living in Washington. And so the distance kind of made it, you know, not as many opportunities to see him on a regular basis. And I think the first time that we went up to see him, he was in a new relationship. So he was in his early, mid to late 20s, I should say, and met a gal. They were living in a house. And he had converted the garage and one of the bedrooms to growing marijuana at home, swore it was a great best business practice. He was going to earn all this money, pay off his debts, get out of the business, just do it. And I thought, okay. And because of my boundaries and my beliefs, I told him that if we were to visit anymore, we wouldn't be staying in his house, because he didn't tell me about that. And I just kind of have some of my own values, and it doesn't allow me to be living or around that type of environment. So I just kind of put my boundaries around that. And again, as far as loss, I knew he started sampling other types of hard drugs, from methamphetamines to heroin to, gosh, you know, anything he could kind of get his hands on. And the stories that started to happen were, it just kind of like out of a movie. I mean, it was so unbelievable to me. It was like, you know, they were doing a delivery and some guy jumped him and they stabbed his partner and stole their money. And the gal that he was with got pregnant. He thought it was his baby. And he went away for a family event, came back. She was gone. The money was gone. And she said the baby wasn't his. So he ended up going to jail for that because he got pretty combative. And after that, he got different menial jobs, and he'd always put on the front with his mom on the phone, "I'm fine, everything's great, I'm just living by myself." And the phone calls got farther and fewer between. And in December, we usually travel, and he called to wish me a happy holiday. And he just, something was drastically different. It's, I don't know if all moms feel that way, but when they speak to their child over the phone, their instinctive self says something's really wrong. Yeah. And so, you know, but he put on a good front. "I'm fine. I've got a good job. Everything's okay." So that at that point, I told my husband, when we get home, I said, "I'm going to Washington. Something's wrong with my son." Sure. And so got back to Eugene, made arrangements with my employer. The next morning, my husband, myself, and our daughter drove to Washington unannounced and found our son so out of his mind and high. I mean, he was hallucinating about everything. He had been evicted from his place. He was still there. No job, no money. Everything had like masking tape everywhere and saran wrap. He knew that there was bugs crawling out of the walls. It was heartbreaking. And so, you know, we just asked the one question and said, "Thomas, are you ready to get some help?" And at that point, he said yes. So we gathered as many things as we could, along with him and his two dogs, and drove him back down to Oregon. He made excuses that he needed to use the restrooms, and I'm sure he went in there to use some more. But at that point, I wanted to get him to a location to get him help. There was nothing available in Washington. We called every number we could imagine, every hospital. They said, "We're full. Come let us know a week from Sunday." I said, "I can't. I need help now."
Right.
So as a mother, that was a pretty difficult situation to be in, where there was no resource. Everybody yes. said, "Well, call us back." It's like, well, isn't there a crisis or a cahoots or whatever? "Oh, no, sorry." So A, it tells me how serious of a problem drugs are in our community.
Absolutely.
And everywhere. My husband had some connections. We were able to get Thomas into, I think it's called Buckley House, or it's a detox place. And brand new journey for me. And so at midnight, we pull up and bring Thomas in there. He has no idea what's going on. I remind him, and I said, "You're going to stay here for a while and get clean." And it was crazy how disorganized everything was in my mind and the situation. Thomas was very compliant. I mean, he was just, you know, he was skinny as a rail. He was mentally incapable of taking care of himself and physically incapable. But, you know, the nightmare had begun for me. I was awake. I was aware. I saw firsthand the damage it was doing to my child. And I knew I needed to do anything that I could possibly do to help him. And I went back faithfully to see him. And, you know, as a young, bright 28-year-old child, he looked like an old man. He was just so disoriented and in so much pain going through detox.
Right.
He couldn't look me in the eye. He couldn't have a conversation. Everything hurt. And up until that point, I hadn't done a lot of my own research about how serious addiction is and how few resources there are to help and where to find those resources. It was just kind of by the grace of God and connections that my husband had that we were able to kind of squeak him in.
Right.
And, you know, so one night I stopped by after work and the gal at the front door, because it's a locked facility, he can leave anytime he wants, but people can't just walk in.
Right.
And she said, "Gus, I'm sorry, he's gone." I said, "Excuse me? What?" She said, "Yeah, he can leave as his own free will." And I went out of my mind. I was in tears. I was hysterical. I wasn't capable. I mean, I was prepared to walk every street in downtown Eugene at an unsafe time by myself, trying to find my son. And, you know, again, by the grace of God, he showed up. And not to me, but back to the facility. Mm-hmm. And they let him back in.
Wow.
So it was crazy. And so once he got clean, he was welcomed into Willamette Family has a men's rehab center, and it's a live-in. And I believe it's government funded because there's a lot of rules. You can't smoke. You got to, you know, get up at this time, brush your teeth at this time, eat at this time. Everybody does chores. And it was a house that was under some extremely strict rules. But I understand that if you have a house full of addicts recovering, there needs to be some guidance. And that seemed to have worked. They had a success formula. And Thomas started going to the NA meetings and the AA meetings that were present. You know, I reached out. I'd been in Al-Anon for a long time for the alcoholics in my life to better understand me. And I started to really kind of dig in a little deeper into my own journey to make sure I was continuing to keep myself healthy, spiritually fit, and mentally fit.
And what, Jeannie, what did that look like for you?
To make sure that I put first things first, that I was okay, that everything I was doing was not just to rescue my son.
And what kind of things were you doing to take care of yourself?
Eating well, making sure I got plenty of rest, made sure that every morning I have my own prayers and meditation program that I do faithfully, being honest and reaching out with others that understand the journey, reaching out to others that maybe I was just an acquaintance with and becoming very clear about the journey that I'm on and looking for some support. You know, there's a lot of, in the beginning, there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of blame for myself. You know, I did something wrong. I should have done this. And gosh, the last thing you want to do when you talk with a new friend or someone is say, you know, well, how many children do you have? And what does your son do? Well, he's an addict and he's, you know, in full blown addiction. And it takes a lot of work for me to be able to understand and differentiate what's my side of the street and what's his. And yeah. I can love him. I'll always love him, but I have to take care of me.
And could you say a little bit more about that? Because I think it's a really powerful distinction for people to understand, particularly moms and dads.
So without having a program to work, at least I can speak to that for me. It's like everything else would start to kind of crumble away. My most intimate relationship, I would become more irritable, more agitated, more impatient, because I wasn't looking at the true problem or challenge that I was trying to manage. For me, if I'm a stuffer, if I try to put on that look good, that's not being my authentic self.
Right.
And, you know, if I just lock the door, stay in my house, don't reach out to people, that's not a healthy way to live my life. Mm-hmm. And I think for anyone that has been in a situation of whether it's abuse or alcoholism or addiction, it's so important to find what whatever support program works for you. There's a lot of 12-step programs out there. That just happens to be the one that works for me.
Yeah.
But we really keep the focus on ourselves.
Correct. Yeah.
And that makes a difference. It's like, and how I communicate with people, you know, is it truthful? Is it honest? Does it have integrity? Is it necessary? Is it kind? And if it's none of those things, I probably should just zip it.
Well, how did you deal with the heartbreak?
You know, I shed a lot of tears. I did a lot of praying. I asked a lot of questions. I mean, you know, the journey went on and on. He actually ended up, went into cardiac arrest and died on the floor in his new wife's house and ended up by ambulance to the hospital. And over the years, I just had to continue to remind myself and reach out to people that I knew I could lean on. What a slippery slope this is. And to continue to do my own inventory to go, okay, so what do you need to be doing right now?
Yeah.
How can you help? You know, if money could cure all, I would have cashed in the bank account a long time ago, but that's not the fix.
Right. Right.
So,
and so how did you, so it sounds like, you know, you reached out to people, you were in Al-Anon, so on and so forth. I think the real challenge for most parents is that it's really not about fixing our child. We have our own journey in this.
Right.
And really getting clear about that and being intentional and having the courage to walk that journey.
Right.
So if you would say a little bit more about kind of your journey and courage and kind of taking your own power back.
Okay. Again, I do my prayers and meditation every morning. And there's always kind of, I call them like a silver lining or a golden nugget. And it's primarily about being willing to let go of the things in life that I have no control over and being okay with it. And what I found is when I live my day, as you said, with intention about doing the things that are right for me.
Yeah.
Everything else works better. My relationships work better. My health is better. I sleep better. Again, one of the telltale signs is if I'm not getting rest, if I can't go to sleep at night because I'm in angst about something, then I need to do more work on self. And to know that there's that support out there. I mean, there's nothing wrong with picking up the phone and calling somebody.
Right.
And if that person's busy, the other thing I learned is it's not about me. That person's busy. Pick up the phone, call somebody else. I mean, that's real living to me. That's the beauty of being in relationship with others is if I seriously work to take care of my own needs, my own health, my own spiritual walk, whatever it is, I will, you know, the law of attraction, I will surround myself with others that are more like-minded, and I'm willing to be open to listen to their truths. I don't know if that answers your question, but one of the biggest things in all this, besides taking care of myself, is I didn't realize how judgmental I was about others, people that were homeless, people that were in addiction. And I like to think that my eyes are wide open now. My heart is wide open.
Was there a moment when that took place, Jeannie?
I think the final straw for me and probably the last tear I shed was when he ended up in the hospital. And we weren't sure if he was going to come out of a coma. We didn't know if he was going to be brain dead. The journey that I've been on with my son has allowed me the privilege of looking back and replaying those old tapes and go, okay, that didn't help. That didn't help. That didn't help. That didn't help. It might have made me think like I was helping, but I needed to kind of let them know I love them, pray for them, whatever that looks like. And then I had to step aside.
Right.
You know, there's not going to be another living arrangement. There's not going to be more money coming in his bank account. There's not going to be another car. Those are just material things. That's not what's going to heal this.
Yeah. Yes. And when was the moment for you that you realized that you had been so judgmental and you kind of, I mean, it sounds like almost an epiphany moment.
Right, right. When he was in the hospital, it was just, it was unbelievable to me that this child that I loved and cherished and cared for, and I knew, you know, he was an addict, but I mean, dang near died because of it.
Right.
And I thought, you know, there's everybody that's out there is somebody else's child, whether they're 60, 20. And I believe in my heart that the drugs choose this life for someone. It's not someone says, oh, I want to do this. I mean, it starts out that way because it might mask a pain or have that euphoria or whatever the high gives them. But it's a very sad journey. So I'm definitely feel that I'm more compassionate and more loving. And yeah, when I see these people, they're just people. They're having trouble. So, and it breaks my heart. I wish that, I mean, I think that Lane County has done a great job. I mean, I've talked with law enforcement. I've talked with counselors. I've talked with professionals. I've talked with, you know, all the rehab centers. There's a lot of help, but we need a lot more.
Yeah. We're in a pandemic.
We are.
Yeah. The institutions and systems are overwhelmed. And so what I'm hearing you say in terms of your own journey is that Al-Anon was particularly powerful for you.
Yes.
And so that has to do with about building a powerful community that you can reach out to and be genuine and authentic and real in your journey and hear other people's journeys and learn along the way. Were there some other things that were pivotal for your journey? And then some like gifts or lessons for you in all of this that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise?
Well, I think the biggest gift was knowing that, I mean, I believe every day there's always an opportunity for him, for others. I just believe that with all my heart, that there's hope. And as far as opportunities, you know, I see all these signs now where it says, you know, be kind and kindness is the way. And I truly feel that that is an important part of our journey. And my responsibility as a human being is our world, our community, everything's just going so fast and so impatient and the sense of urgency, but it's a sense of urgency about everything that's not relevant to being a real authentic person.
Right.
And so I've learned to really slow it down and breathe. Mm-hmm. Sometimes at night, those nights that I couldn't sleep, I would just sit there and practice breathing, and I would count to like three in and three out, and I would do it over and over and over. So yeah, you got to find what tools work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with slowing your pace down, how has that impacted your life?
I'm not as frantic. I don't have those hills and valleys as far as if an event happens, whether it's with him or someone else. Usually my best practice is I want to say, how can I help? Because maybe somebody doesn't want my help. Maybe I can just be helpful by offering, but making sure people know that I care about them. I think that's really important too. So
who's been the most influential for you in terms of being there for you?
My husband. He's my rock.
Yeah. And what did you learn about him during this process?
That you can be loving and supportive and at the same time have boundaries that are non-negotiable. It's an interesting combination, but it's really important. You need to know what you're willing to do and what you're not, period. So, and he made that clear the whole journey about what he'd be willing to do and what he wouldn't. And I respect him for that.
And what did you learn from him in terms of creating your own boundaries?
One, that it's okay to do.
Okay.
You know, there's in our program in Al-Anon, you know, we talk about detachment with love. And,
right,
you know, that can look very differently in all types of situations. But I need to pause often before I commit to something. So I really understand, okay, so what is this about? What are you doing this for? Is there an ulterior motive? Are you being sincere? Do you think this other person can't do it themselves? I mean, you know, so many times it's very easy to jump right in to somebody else's journey, and then they don't get the experience that they rightfully deserve. So we think we're being helpful, but sometimes I'm not. So.
And so you're more aware of that now.
Sure.
And it sounds like you have, you know, a heightened inner dialogue around this to question, okay, what are my motives? You know, what are my intentions here? And has that come out of all of this too? Is that clarity of internal motivations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. My son's in prison now. He's been there for a year, and I had the opportunity to go see him face to face. I did some footwork around that too. And I knew my goal was to see him. That was it. I didn't ask him about his addiction, his recovery. What's he going to do when he gets out? I didn't want to interview him. That was not what the goal was. The goal was to see my child. And that's what I did. And it was a great visit. So.
And how did you set yourself up for success in that visit?
Reached out to others, asked for their love and support. And I even arranged the appointment in the middle of the day. So I was not rushed. I wasn't tired. I wasn't distracted. I think it's really important as far as being clear with myself, as far as what is it I need? Well, I need to make sure that I know how to get to this place because I've never been there.
Right.
And so, you know, it would not be in my best interest to make it first thing in the morning, and I didn't want to make it last thing in the day. So yeah, I was intentional about how I planned that meeting. And I made sure that when I got out, I parked my car off the property and I sat and I called a friend and just said, okay, this was great. And the cool thing about it for me is my heart was wide open for him. There was no tears. There was nothing to cry about. I was just so happy to see my child. And I know that everything is possible for him, and I'll be his biggest fan. That's all I get to do.
Yeah. And so what's the one thing that you wished you'd known at the beginning that you know now?
A deeper understanding of how this pandemic of drug addiction literally alters someone's mind, their brain, the chemical imbalance. You know, I was unclear about all that. I figured, well, if they want to stop, they could stop. I stopped smoking 35 years ago. What's the big deal? And so I figured that it would be the same, which was pretty ignorant on my part. So yeah, to me, it's to not be in denial and to pay attention and look for resources, whether that's through books or a doctor that you trust or a friend that's had the same experience. Gather all the information and then form your own opinion.
Right. And so how did you begin to learn about the effects of addiction on people's brains?
Being honest with a friend, with a neighbor.
Okay.
And, yeah, you know, that person shared the information that she had and was open to providing resources. I feel that, you know, it did a couple of things. It deepened a relationship with someone that I probably wouldn't have grown to have and call a friend. And that's pretty special to me. And knowing that there's more tools in my toolbox now is huge. And I had no idea. And I guess a good word for that, like I said, is denial. I had no clue.
Yeah. And so just for people that are listening to this interview, is there a particular video or book or resource that you found that was really pivotal for you?
There are several. My memory's not very good on it, but the last book I read is Under Our Roof. So Under Our Roof, A Son's Battle for Recovery and a Mother's Battle for Her Son. Great book, great story. Could really understand the journey. And, you know, people don't become addicts because they hate their moms or they you know, it has nothing to do with that loving, nurturing relationship. It's a whole different journey. So I think it's important to not confuse that because, but there's other videos that I've watched. There's other books that I've read. I can't remember the name of them. But there is some great resources out there. And I had no idea that it literally changes the chemical functions of somebody's brain.
Yeah. Well, I know earlier on in our journey, I had gone to, I think, Sam's second, maybe third rehab. And I asked the people at the front desk, what do you recommend?
Right.
Because I was on a massive learning. I wanted to know as much as I could about the disease, not only for the addict, but also for the family. And so trying to find resources that were family oriented, that were that moms, dads, friends, spouses, all of it that we could have access to that would help us. I mean, they go to a facility. Where do we go?
Right.
You know, and so that, which is one of the major reasons why Voices in Courage has been born, is because I had to cobble together the resources to learn about this. And I was shocked, actually, that it was this hard for a mom to find the information that I needed, to talk to the people that knew about this disease that could help me figure out how to navigate this. And my first experience was watching Pleasure Unwoven by a doctor who is a recovering addict. And the whole video was about, is this a choice or is this a disease? And that was a pivotal movie for me.
Right.
And then that led to more and more and more information and clarity and so on and so forth that really helped shift my perceptions of what was going on too. So there is some great resources out there. It's just, we really have to look for them and find them and pick the ones that work and let go of the rest. And then there are books too that, you know, have slices of information that's super helpful. And then there's other pieces I don't necessarily agree with. So, you know, figuring out what resonates with you and letting the rest of it go, I think is, you know, just part of the journey.
Right. I agree. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what would be three of the recommendations you would make to somebody who is new to this journey?
Don't give up. I think it's really important. It would help me, as you can call it finding your tribe, but finding that group of people or person that is either walked the journey or can point you in the direction of the resources. You know, as we just talked about, as you mentioned, it's so important to know the facts.
Yes.
And it's so overwhelming. It's like the things that I've done and seen in the last 15, 20 years is unbelievable. It was beyond my wildest dreams. And so I could either stand there and be shell-shocked or do something about it. And I chose to do something about it because I couldn't change the other person. I needed to work on me. So goodness, and never give up hope. To me, that's important.
Yeah. Do you think that you would have done the personal work if it hadn't been for this?
No. You know, it's kind of like a diet. You don't go on a diet until your clothes don't fit you anymore. So you're going to just keep eating cream pie. I don't know. Yeah, there wasn't a need. And again, the gift to me was becoming so much more aware. You know, once you're awake and you're aware, it's time to take some action. So, and that action for me was learning more about addiction, learning how it alters someone's mind, finding resources, people, making sure I'm still taking care of myself in this journey. You know, as you mentioned, it's they're in rehab or they're in prison or they're whatever, but here you are just sitting here holding your hands out, hoping that somebody's going to give you the answer. And, you know, it's a real precious time to make sure that you hold people that you love, that your partners or your spouses or, you know, don't push them away, hold them close. And they may not understand it either. So, yep, it's, unfortunately, there's nobody that's immune to this. And we all need to get on the bandwagon.
Right. Do you think that it has made your marriage stronger?
Absolutely. Yep. No question in my mind.
Yeah. And who did you need to be in order to strengthen that marriage through this journey?
I needed to be a partner that was honest and kept clear about my goals and what was important. I think that if I would have allowed this to just, you know, the cavernous hole and just swallow me up, emotions, heart, and everything, it would have been very damaging. So yeah, being my true authentic self and taking care of myself.
Yeah.
And asking for what you need. If you need something, say it.
Yeah. And so have you gotten much better at asking for help?
Yes. Yeah. Those old actions don't work so good. You got to say the word.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I know in our story, I never had problems asking for help, but I did go through this period where I was giving Sam money and I wasn't telling, you know, my spouse. And I absolutely in it knew that that was part of my work and figuring out like how to navigate that in truth and integrity. And what was that really about for me? And so that took some digging in, you know, to really, really wrestle with the devil from that perspective.
Yeah. There's a saying that we have when we say our secrets keep us sick. So, and you know, the other thing is just take it one day at a time. Don't try to take on the whole world. Just you're right here, right now, today. That's all you got to worry about. Just 1 minute at a time sometimes, because we can't change what's happened.
No. I know for me personally, the one question that has just been pivotal and continues to be pivotal is what are the gifts and lessons embedded in this experience, this journey? And I just keep leaning into that on a daily basis. And it continues to, the answers continue to rise up. And I'm, you know, I don't ever consider myself done on this.
Right.
That it is, I mean, Sam's addiction, and I wrote him a thank you note for it, actually, because it was the most powerful push for me personally to do my spiritual work and to become more conscious and more aware and continue to be on that path.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly don't believe it would have happened if it hadn't been for him, because, you know, our kids are that powerful for us.
Right.
Or hold the potential for being that powerful for us as parents. So I chose to seize that opportunity.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would agree.
And so is there something that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you so far? Let me ask you that.
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess as far as what the future holds and what I will do from here forward, and besides practicing my program and doing the spiritual walk, you know, I think for all of us, it's so important to have, there's something greater than ourselves and whatever that looks like. And to me, I know I'm never alone, ever, in any journey. And I won't be tomorrow or the next day. So I think that it's so important for us to have our eyes wide open and see what's going on. And we can stand back and go, it's heartbreaking and this is sad. Or we need to stand up and go, okay, so how do we have tools for this and resources and how do we help? Because I think that there, as we've talked about, that's the greatest thing as far as what I will do forward is continue to have my eyes wide open. And maybe that's somebody in a meeting that is going down a journey and just to reach out and go, I hear you. I've been there. It's pretty powerful. It's nice. It's pivotal. It's not nice to know that you're not alone.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of just research, the research is very, very clear that not only for the addict or the alcoholic, but for the family members, for the friends that are dealing with someone that they love, it is as critically important to have a support system, a tribe of people that love you and will tell you the truth, and that you can be completely vulnerable and honest in who you are in this journey. Because, I mean, you know, there's so many tears and so much heartbreak and so much desperation. And the ups and downs of all of this. And I know from, you know, from a societal perspective that the journey is much more possible in a healthy way when you have a great tribe.
I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do believe that's one of the gifts that's coming out of this experience for people who are willing to reach out and find people that are going through the journey, because the numbers in terms of friends that we have, we're on the decline, you know, in terms of the whole of our society. And so in my weird kind of way of thinking about things, I see that this is one piece of the gifts in this experience, is that our tribe is mission critical, so to speak.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So for some of us, that requires us to kind of up our skills in creating relationships that are true and honest and integrity driven and vulnerable and all of that. And yeah, so.
Yeah. Lots of lessons.
Lots of lessons. Yeah. So do you have any questions for me?
Well, not a question, but a comment. I am really excited for you on this journey. I am thrilled that you're doing the good work you're doing.
Thank you.
I think it's important. I wish you the very best on this journey and many successes. I mean, you know, it's like win the day. If you can touch someone's heart and their mind, and they know they're not going down this journey by themselves.
Right.
That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. Cause it's a battle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you're going to war. So what are you going to arm yourself with?
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge, understanding, compassion. That'd be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. And, you know, our intention is to create a safe community for people to come to.
Right.
To get the resources that they need, have the community that will be a place for them, and continue to learn, continue to stretch, continue to be in our own journey in this.
Right.
And understand that out of this experience, we get to up-level ourselves from a conscious perspective. And I think, honestly, be better human beings. Well, I really, really, really appreciate your time and your sharing your journey with our community today. So
I appreciate you asking.
Absolutely.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.